Welcome to the Education Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Journal Club. Here in our PCRF Journal Club, we promote evidence-based practices by critically evaluating the latest science in emergency medical services. We hope our discussion will help advance EMS practice. Through the generous support of our sponsor, Limmer Education, we can make science more accessible and understandable. So welcome everyone to the August 2024 Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum, Education Research Journal Club. We are joining you live from Pittsburgh at the 2024 NEMC EMS Educator Symposium and Trade Show.
I feel like we should say live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. It's the PCRF.
Yes. And we're sitting down here with Mike Caduce, of course. I'm Megan Corey. And we are going to discuss a really great article. First, I want to thank a few people. One is Limmer Education for bringing us these podcasts. The other is NEMC for help letting us do this live from this symposium. We've had a really great symposium so far. I've attended a couple of sessions that I know I'm going to take some practical things back to my classroom. I saw something on escape rooms. We did something on escape rooms. Yeah,
absolutely.
And I got some more practical ideas from Bob Page, I think was who presented the escape rooms. Yeah, he gave us some great, like, tangible things to take home, which was great. And the other thing I love about this conference is people are so generous with their sharing. They're so generous with their, their experiences, whether it's positive or negative. So
I told Dan Batsy, because he presented on community in your classroom as the opening session, I said, last at AMC I heard him present, I stole something from what he talked and implemented it. And so I'm going to do the same thing with some of the things he does with how to build community within your classroom. So yeah, I think everyone here is willing to share ideas, collaborate. Oftentimes I think we say we don't have time to reinvent the wheel every time. So why don't you find these people that are already doing it?
Absolutely.
And this conference is full of people.
Yep, that's true. And the third person that I'd like to thank is Sahej Khalsa, who is actually in the room with us. We are in kind of a boardroom type setting here. So we've got a little round table of folks that are here with us. And one of those people is Sahej Khalsa. I want to thank you for sending us this article. And we want to hear from you a little bit on this article too. This is a really good one. And actually, when Dan Batsy was presenting yesterday, he mentioned growth mindset.
Oh, yes.
And absolutely. I said, oh, this is great. And then we also have Dr. Heather Davis sitting with us, and she is presenting tomorrow on growth mindset, which I think is fantastic. Kim McKenna is standing by in the chat. So if anybody would like to remember, you can go into the chat and talk amongst yourselves, and Kim can, you know, provide links or discussion, spark some questions, discussion, answer questions, and then we'll bring those into our conversation too as we go. So I want to start with Sahej. You chose this article. The article we're looking at is The Growth Mindset Messages from Instructors Improve Academic Performance Among First-Generation College Students. And this comes from an open access article, by the way, CBE, which stands for Chemistry, Biological Engineering, something like that. Life Sciences Education. It's out of higher education. So I'd like to know, you know, what drew you to this and how did you find this article?
Yeah, so the article was actually shared with the NEMC board. I'm a very recently past NEMC board member, and it was shared with our board and with our faculty of our IC1 class by Connie Matera. And so she found it and shared it, and I took a look at it, and I thought it was really impactful and really meaningful, and has some very easy takeaways for educators to apply in their classrooms and with their students, and that in this study were shown to close some gaps. And I think people know I'm a advocate for DEI, and this is a potentially underappreciated DEI issue that we can tomorrow start making a really significant impact if we implement some of the things that the authors here did and that they found in their research.
That's great. And I want to bring you in. You mentioned the supplemental materials before we came on. This article does have supplemental materials. If you can't link, if you search the article, you can find it online. And if you click on an area that really, you know, connects you to the materials, there's some real tangible things that you can take and use. And so we're going to have you come back and talk about that a little bit when we get there. So the problem that this research is trying to address is specifically an equity group known as a first generation college student. So there's first generation college student, and as they abbreviate FG,
yeah.
and the CG, the continuing generation college student. And the, we know that from prior research that first generation college students tend to have worse academic outcomes as compared to continuing generation college students. And by that, we mean retention, completion, overall GPA, the kind of outcomes that you think about, engagement, a sense of belonging, all of these things. A first generation college student may, you know, fare worse than a continuing generation college student.
Absolutely, Megan. And I think, like, I'm trying to think back to the both the programs I've taught and the program I took. No one ever asked, did my parents graduate from college, which we maybe don't always think of in paramedic school, but we know that's a profound indicator of success or a performance metric for success. So it makes you think all the things we're going to talk about around growth mindset can improve our performance in our class, but we just maybe need some of those questions to echo what Sahej said. It's maybe not one of the things that comes to mind when we always think DEI, but it does as a performance metric in or an indicator for performance in the classroom. So, and maybe it is a question that we start asking students, or I don't know if it's something we include in things like demographic surveys and stuff, but it's definitely a question that
I want to say too, though, if you are in an institution, the odds are your research, because they are accredited by an institutional accreditor, you will have typically a requirement to collect specific demographic information. So connect with your research office or your institutional effectiveness office. You can usually get data that are already collected, including things like veteran status, first generation, demographics by race, by sometimes by, you know, English language learning level. So it really might vary state by state, or actually accreditor by accreditor, but in general, there's that that's actually measured. Mm-hmm. So that might be data that you have that you don't have to try and tap into yourself. So check that first, because it might be already there. The other thing I wanted to just sidebar on was the definition of first generation college student. And we were talking about this before. I asked Heather Davis, so Dr. Davis is here with us, and I asked, when did they redefine this? Because I know 42 years ago, when I, you know, went into college, that the definition of first generation college student was any college was if you're either of your parents, you were first generation, if either of your parents only had either a high school diploma or had no college at all, whether that was an associate degree or even some college, you were considered first generation if neither of your parents had any college.
Yeah.
So now the definition in this paper, I was a little surprised to see that, but I'm sure it changed years ago and I just didn't know, is either parent that they don't have a bachelor's degree. Mm-hmm. So I would assume that means if your parent has an associate degree or some college, they would not be, that student wouldn't be considered first generation. So is that...
Yeah, I don't think that it's universal yet. And so that would be important to look, just make sure we know what we're talking about, right? Yeah. So whenever we're looking at research, it's sort of like, what is your definition? And then how do we know, kind of thing, so that we're comparing apples to apples. But the conversation we were having before we started was about what we know in terms of persistence and access to information. That's really where this first generation conversation comes up, is that if you have a parent or really anybody in your close family network who has gone to college, then they know how to do a FAFSA. They know how to do financial aid. They know how to sign up for classes. They know what deadlines are. They know how to navigate this system. They know about residency and housing and on campus and getting involved in clubs. And if you don't have a parent who's done that, somebody close in your family network, an auntie or something like that, then you're absent of that information. And that's where learners struggle, is because then they, as the learner, are learning it firsthand and trying to teach their family about those things. And so what we know is that there's some sometimes is a difference in those experiences in a community college setting, because the learner is often still at home. They're not living residentially, usually in a community college setting. And so many of those sort of experiences and opportunities to engage and be on campus and some of the things that can create barriers or can create isolation or lack of belonging don't exist the same way. And so that might be where this paper chose to make a definition or create that separation. And so I think it's something for all of us to pay attention to when we're looking at this distinction between first generation and continuing generation. But I don't think that we'll find it universally now in all the papers. I don't think there was a date in which that is.
Oh, that's good to know. It's good to know. It's good to know the definition, because when they do ask that question on things, they usually allow you to click bubbles that say, you know, how, which level of, you know, my parent had an associate degree or a high school diploma or GED or whatever. So I do think that that's important. It actually makes it even more compelling when we get into the study too, because that's a pretty high bar to set for first generation to say, oh, well, if neither of your parents had a bachelor's degree, and we're still going to see some interesting, you know, stuff in this paper. So that's the first thing I would say, is that the definition of first generation is really important. And then they talk about some of the impacts. So the things that Dr. Davis talked about here, about what, you know, what are some of the issues that they have to deal with. You know, it's very hard to adapt to college if you're not familiar with it, or if your family can't help you navigate, a great word, all of the administrative stuff. But also there's the, you know, kind of the, and I think the paper calls it kind of maybe an underappreciated barrier, which is the fixed mindset of instructors. So fixed mindset messages by instructors. So the idea that these differences between first generation and continuing generation students may be exacerbated by these subtle messages from science instructors, is who they talk about mostly, as, you know, conveying this idea that you have to have natural talent in order to succeed. And those kinds of things, I even have UGG written on my paper here. When they talk about weeding out, weeding out people.
I think we underlined and highlighted, I highlighted the same paragraph that talks a little bit about this. The instructors, the next step is, right, instructors have a mindset, but they also communicate that to their students. And the way you would communicate a fixed mindset would be with the words that, like, you can pick who's going to fail and pass just within the first 2 seconds of a class or within the first exam. And I think it probably makes all of us around the table cringe when we hear an instructor say they can choose who's going to pass or fail their class. But I thought it was important that they pointed that out, and they cited some research that's actually looked at that fixed mindset in students and how that doesn't set your students up for success. So I hate the comments, but I didn't know that there was actual research into it.
Yeah. So research, the theory that we're citing is the fixed versus growth mindset. And that's Carol Dweck in that great book, Growth Mindset. If you haven't read that, that's a really good read. And then the subsequent research that followed on fixed versus growth mindset. And we actually looked at an article with Dr. Nadelman, I think years ago, a couple of years ago, on faculty equity mindset, which really is growth mindset, and the impact. And STEM was the field where they saw the biggest differences, the biggest negative impact of having a fixed mindset and more fixed mindset instructors. So not too surprising here. But then to follow up, like with what you said, they give examples of what kinds of things would be, you know, the quick judgments of a student based upon a single test performance, recommending that they drop rather than seek resources. Those are fixed mindset messages versus a growth mindset message, which, by the way, is not a trophy for all message. It's not a, you know, you're all wonderful and you're all going to do great. It's very specific, and, you know, targeting, like, you know, a sense of belonging, you know, suggesting academic effective learning strategies to work on, and you know, getting them to, you know, believe that their ability is malleable, that they can actually develop over time with application of these effective learning strategies. So that was really important. And then this author herself actually has some prior research showing the impact of growth mindset messages from instructors. And in particular, I thought it was interesting that emails, even just electronic messages, were impactful on engagement, on student engagement. So I think they wanted to follow up now by taking that one more step and looking at the impact on actual, you know, to examine, and this is the objective, whether growth mindset versus control instructor messages, and this is by email, will increase their performance among first generation college students in an introductory biology course. And a great selection, because an introductory biology course is a gatekeeper course to STEM. So when we think about our own gatekeeper courses, you know, what could we, you know, apply this to, you know, looking at what are their differences, and then can we affect those through growth mindset interventions?
Can I just add something about, so this notion that instructors, educators are communicating to their students a growth or a fixed mindset happens not just explicitly, right? Like,
yes,
occasionally we get those instructors who are like, nope, you're not going to make it. But it also happens implicitly in a bunch of different ways. Who do you support when they ask questions? Who do you encourage when they're struggling to stay in the class versus say, yeah, you know what? Probably not for you. You should drop out. So if, for the educators listening to this, if you're like, well, I would never tell a student explicitly, you're not going to be successful and you are, that's not the only way this is communicated to students. In fact, that's probably not the majority of it. Instead, it's these implicit messages that we're sending out to students. Well, yeah, that one, you're sending a message, that individual's just smarter. Yeah. You're not as smart, therefore you're less likely to be successful. Not in so many words, but in other actions and statements that you're making to students.
Yeah.
So it's not always this explicit, overt communication of, you ain't going to make it. But that's the message that's received by students with other ways of us communicating with them.
Yeah.
So very closely related to deficit mindset, yes, as well. And I think as instructors, we sometimes do this as well, where we think we're being kind by sort of making excuses for student performance by saying things like, well, they have a lot of barriers. You know, they've got a lot going on. This is a single parent, or they're, you know, their housing is unstable. They can't possibly get here to school when they've got all this other stuff going on. So we're thinking that we're helping by making excuses for what their poor performance is, instead of thinking, how do we help solve those problems, or how do we provide the academic support so that it can free up room and space for them to address those other issues that they bring to the table. And we want to appreciate what else they may bring to the table when they are coming to class every day, because there is a lot of trauma and a lot of experience that people do bring that does take up their cognitive load. But we have to get away from that deficit thinking and thinking that that could keep them from being successful. And what we want to think is everybody has potential to be successful, and provide all of our energy equally to everyone, and communicate those messages of, I'm so glad you're here.
Yeah.
You could be great at this. I've seen other students in your situation do amazing things. And there are patients out there who have come from circumstances like yours, who are going to relate to you and will love having you as a provider. Those are the kinds of messages. So we have to sort of flip that. And I do think that sometimes we think we're being compassionate, but it really is something called deficit mindset.
Yes. Deficit guilty. Oh, this article really made me reflect. And what you're saying really makes me reflect, especially on what you're saying. You want to be compassionate, but you don't want to be. And I love the way you said that about, you know, patients are patients out there who could relate.
And it just, it's so profound. Mm-hmm. Just thinking through this is how we get those students out into the field, right? Because every patient relates to a different provider in different ways. And we need all of those people making it through our EMT and our paramedic classes to get out there into the field.
Yep. True. So what this group wanted to do, though, was to take these biology students. So this is, again, in a single college. So there are going to be limitations, like we always talk about in research. There will be limitations. But they did. This is from a single college. These are undergraduate students. 553 undergraduate students were eligible.
Yep.
An intro biology course. It was in spring of 2021, which they say is unusual because do I have to say the word again? COVID. and it was entirely online. So this course typically, I would imagine, was either hybrid or in person, and it was an entirely online course. And the final actually undergraduate student population that they ended up with was 417 after a number of, enrollment exclusions. They surveyed the students pre and post semester to measure their own personal mindset about their fixed or growth mindset, which is important. And then they collected demographic information and GPA as they enter. And then they randomly assigned the students to either a control group or an intervention group. The control group and intervention group both would receive an introductory kind of email. And again, the supplemental materials are really great. And I'm going to have Sahej comment a little bit more on the details of that. But an introductory email that has a general message to the student. This would be after an exam. So following taking an exam, they would get an email about the results of the exam, how they scored and how they did. The intervention group would get the same email, but also have a growth mindset intervention with a follow-up with these strategies. Now, the intervention, the thing I loved about this, so they talked about a lot of details here. One is the messaging itself, and the other is the timing of the messaging. Timing was really important. It wasn't just, let's just throw out all these, flowery messages to people. It was timed at a couple of time points, not just one intervention, but multiple time points for persistence, I think, too. And keeping that retention, also key points in a semester. Think about how you come in kind of excited, then maybe you don't do so well on an exam. You maybe keep going, but if you don't do so well again, that might be it. And you might be getting some messages that maybe I don't feel like I belong in college, and that kind of thing. So the timing, I thought, was important.
I think we can all think through watching our paramedic students and the ebbs and the flows of the EMT class. And like that, I sort of think like the midterm depression that our students go through as they're studying and sort of being really just being challenged. And then they come out a little bit more motivated. And then like the 2-week period right before they graduate, it's like, just please put in some effort. We're almost there. I also, the moment that I thought was really interesting, the highlight that I made from this is they were very detailed in what they wrote in the email, and so that they could employ the growth mindset. But instead of saying, here's some growth mindset strategies that might help you be effective, they actually wrote it in to say, past students have found this to be effective. And they incorporated that into the email. So instead of cramming for your test all at once, do the reading throughout the course, showing up to this class every day, study with a group, create concept maps, identify information gaps instead of rewriting or retyping notes. So I thought that was a really unique way of doing it. Instead of just saying, here's what we think the science tells us will work, they actually sort of turned it into a unique experience from previous students. And I was like, I would not have thought necessarily to do that. That was a really interesting way to do it. And I wonder if that gets you more buy-in from your students' willingness to be like, oh, other people have done it. I'll do it too.
Yeah. In the email, so I wanted to bring Sahej in on this too. So in the emails and in the supplemental materials, you'll see both the email that's sent out to the control group and the intervention group. And one of the things I appreciate is they grounded this entire thing in theory. So they picked the three areas of Dweck's, of the theory of growth mindset. The number one was that your abilities can be improved. Number two was the academic struggles are normal to experience, which is something you were getting at. And the third one is academic struggles are the result of controllable rather than uncontrollable factors. And then they followed that up with effective strategies. So when you saw those supplement materials, you said they really hit you.
Yeah, I think it's as you pointed out, they're based on those three major things, but then they communicated in a conversational sort of way, like not, hey, here's the evidence of what you need to do, which I don't think is an approachable way to communicate, especially to, new college students. But they said, hey, here's what other students have done to be successful. And there were a couple of pieces that I thought were really impactful, right? So yes, the strategies, but they also started out, particularly in the intervention group who was below average on the first exam, they started out by saying, you're not alone, right? Other students struggled on this exam as well. And other students have struggled on this exam in the past and then ultimately been successful. So this is changeable, right? As you said, it's in your control. And then they set expectations when they communicated. They said, you're not going to wake up tomorrow and immediately do great, but you can still be successful. And then they said, and here's what the quote that I jumped out about that setting expectations, learning is a process that occurs over time. And it requires input of effort on your part, right? And then they gave specific steps with which he talked about, those five specific steps, which were all very actionable. And they all probably, they're targeted to take people from a sort of fixed mindset of how do I study? Well, I take notes, I read my book, I highlight, I whatever. And instead gave them growth mindset strategies to study. Study every day. Put an hour aside a day to be successful. Study with a group, right? We talked about, Dan Batsy talked about community. Mm-hmm. We know that when there's community in a classroom, students are more likely to be successful. So they said, hey, if you're studying alone, find a group to study with. Brought in the idea of concept maps. Instead of just taking notes, make a concept map that helps you build connections and bring disparate ideas together. Don't read and just reread your text. Yeah. And then identify your areas of weakness and then revisit them. And then they said, hey, look, the closing was essentially hard work, perseverance, learning from past mistakes, seeking help, and applying effective learning strategies will help you be successful. I'm available. Come talk to me. Right. And some of the language was common between both conditions, mm-hmm. sort of the nuts and bolts of the here's the score, here's how it was graded. They said, don't ask me to curve. There's no changing, which I think is probably standard. Right.
And I'm available. I like that too. Available. Everyone to know that you're available. Themselves
very clearly available to the students. Yeah. Right. And so those struck me as something that we could start doing tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Right. If we're on a sort of standard Northern Hemisphere schedule, we're probably starting classes in the next week, or we just started them. There's no reason we couldn't take this language, modify it a little bit to our setting, and start communicating with our students after whatever that first hurdle is, mm-hmm. right? They identified this exam one as a hurdle that tripped up a lot of their students and they would exit this course. And again, as he pointed out, a gatekeeper course. So this is maybe determinative of does the student end up in STEM or not?
Yeah.
And so we could start implementing this, fairly low bar for us to start implementing this. And I think it's also important that we don't just communicate this, but that we actually internalize and believe this because mm-hmm. it's true and we should believe it.
Yeah. Yeah. Good points. So they sent out this email. And then their outcomes that they were going to be looking at. Was it the same email again after the second intervention or similar?
It was similar. So there was similar, the intervention group got a similar growth mindset email that didn't mm-hmm. have the same level of detail of the steps, but it was a positive, you can do it, growth mindset email. Just more concise and edited a little bit.
Yeah. And I appreciated the whole idea of not promoting or perpetuating a false growth mindset through kind of platitudes, you know, giving them, you know, some kind of terminology without any kind of framework. They also mentioned something about a motivational framework.
I was just going to say they called it a motivational framework.
Okay. So help me with this one, because somebody did a presentation that I missed yesterday. I was in something else. On motivating the unmotivated student. Did any of you guys go to that one? Okay. So the motivational framework now, I saw that and I went, oh, okay. What does that mean? What is the motivational framework?
Are you ready for me?
What did you learn?
You got to barge into.
Yes. I love this area of learning and motivation. And when we teach them together, learning theory and the motivation theories. The whole back half of the semester is all the motivation theories. And it really resonates with this idea that strategies are one thing, but if you're not motivated to use them, that they're really hardwired together. They're very connected. That learning and performance are very connected in terms of both learning and motivation. And so the idea is that if people have strategies, they still have to be motivated to use those strategies. Sometimes it's not skill, it's will, right? We procrastinate. We have to think of, we have to have it's choice, persistence, and effort. Those are the three indices of motivation. Sometimes I just don't choose to do it. I am procrastinating, or I'm making up reasons in my head about why I can't, or I don't want to, or other things are more important. Or I start, but I don't persist because it's hard, or I don't have the right strategies, or I don't have a study group, or I don't feel like I belong, or for whatever reason, I don't persist. I close the computer and I push it away, or I'm not using the right amount of mental effort. So choice, persistence, and effort are those indices of motivation. So what the paper was saying is that the strategies have to come with the right amount of motivation. You have to help people see that it is possible. And that's where you saw those pieces, those messages, those sentences around, and other students have done it. And I have worked with students who have been in your shoes. That idea, there's a great other paper from this same life science education journal that shared that teachers who share their journey with their pedagogical choices, the struggles they had, and the strategies they used also help underrepresented students persist by 20%. And so when you start adding these 20% and 10% and another 20% here, all of a sudden you see how we get all of those learners over the finish line.
Yeah.
And so it's great when we have a sense of community and learners can help each other do this, but you as the leader in the classroom can also do it. Yeah. And so they're simple sentences. I have worked with other students in your shoes. Yeah. I've had a lot of students like this. Like Sahej said, that sentence about it's common for learners to struggle on this first test, but to go on and have success on other courses. The sentence in the article was to raise their scores on subsequent exams by 30 or 40 points. You can imagine how motivating that might be, because somebody looking at a score of a 30 or 40, you know, they're thinking, I got to drop this class by the deadline.
Yeah.
I got to get out of here before it goes on my transcript. And so to see a message, a motivational framework of, okay, it's possible it to actually bring my score up, and I'm not going to just get it, you know, because somebody thinking, I'm in a hole. Can I dig myself out of this hole of a score this bad on the first one or two exams? That's that motivation of, do I even bother to try? It's around some of those same ideas of why in some courses you don't get a zero if you actually did the assignment, no score less than a 50% or something, because a zero is really hard to come back from, that you at least get partial credit and then you allow revisions, like some of those kinds of ideas. Help seeking behavior is another sort of motivational idea that our learners struggle with. When you look at how many come to office hours, how many come to tutoring, how many come to some of those help, you're saying I'm available, but then you're sitting by yourself in your office and there's nobody there. But there are many instructors who offer credit just for showing up. You don't even have to come with any questions. Just show up and I'll give you a point at 2 points for it or whatever. And it's to encourage those help-seeking behaviors for office hours, come to tutoring, study groups, but to build the reward for participating in help-seeking behaviors.
That's great. I never thought about that one. Okay, so let's move on to seeing what happened here. So like I said, their outcomes that they were looking at were the scores on the exams, the course GPA, and another one I love is activity on the learning management system. So keep in mind, this is an online class. So when we're talking about all of these interventions, this is an online class. So we're looking at kind of two separate things. We have a control and an intervention, but then within that, we've got the comparison of the groups, the first generation versus continuing generation. And then also they looked at underrepresented minorities and non-underrepresented minorities. And in one of their, if you notice in the STEM fields, underrepresented minority, the groups they included were Black, Hispanic, Native American, or Pacific Islander, and non-underrepresented minorities were white or Asian. And this is very specific, of course, to the STEM fields as well. So at a baseline, it's important to notice that the continuing generation of college students have a higher GPA than first generation. And at the end of the course, that stays the same, that the continuing generation has a higher overall GPA than first generation. There was no difference in the GPA at start at the start of the course between the underrepresented minority group and the non-underrepresented minority group at baseline. At the end of the course, however, the underrepresented minority group GPA was lower than those in the underrepresented minority group. And this is in the total groups, not looking at the subgroups, because once they get down to the subgroups, the sample size gets small. And so they commented that they really don't know, the test of the intervention is unknown, even though they saw a small effect that, it's not significant. So they advised caution, which I always love when researchers do that, advising caution in interpreting results. But it does suggest their results were more dependent upon the generational status, meaning first generation versus continuing generation.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that they tracked course GPA as well. I think sometimes we don't evaluate how the learning strategies you're getting in one class impact you in another class. Mm-hmm. It'd also probably be interesting to track their GPAs throughout the next semester or many, because some of these things that you're giving to your students may click and then help them in their other classes. So when I first read the paper, I was like, in one semester, your GPA is probably not fluctuating that much, but I underestimate the value of this sort of encouragement that they're getting, this growth mindset that they're getting in their class.
Yeah. And the other thing is, so this is a table of the raw means and standard deviations by condition and generational status. And the important thing of looking at that is to see that you can see the starting point. And then what they're really going to look at, and we'll see this in the two figures, are the changes that occur. And then what we're really looking at, and when we're looking at equity science, is the gaps, is changing gaps, is making it so that everyone has the opportunity to achieve and to achieve what they've desired to when they start out. So, but this illustrates that these are the time points that they actually looked at. So after exam two, exam three, the course GPA, and then the access to the learning management system. And they looked at two points of access, and they didn't just randomly select that either. That was based on science. And that's the science in distance education about who tends to what tends to improve a student's performance. And usually it has to do with them engaging in the content and the materials. So they looked at course content access and then gradebook access, which I thought was pretty good.
That made me chuckle too. Every time I do something, I go look and see how it impacts my grade. Yeah.
A lot of times if you use a learning management system, the gradebook is accessed to see if they're missing assignments. Yep. So because sometimes they don't have some other way of monitoring their assignments, and maybe they don't use the calendar function or whatever else. But the gradebook, that'll definitely tell them if they're missing something. Go ahead.
And I just thought the course content access I thought was compelling as well, right? There's more course content access in the intervention group they were. And so if we're, online educators often are struggling to say, hey, engage with the material, get in the course, get in Moodle, get in Canvas, get in Blackboard, get in whatever. Well, this communication seemed to have an effect with more engagement with the material, not just with the gradebook, which is good, but with the core content of the class as well. So if you're like me, one of those educators who teaches online, and you're wondering, how do you get students to engage with all of this great material that you found or created or brought in that you've put online? This seems to be a way that's, again, pretty easy entry to get your students more engaged with that content that you really want them to engage with.
Yeah, and you can tell the difference between I've just opened this page and left the room and I'm engaged in the material, because right. It's that granular. You can get into numbers of clicks on which pages and how long you viewed something. And so it'll at least give you an idea of engagement in that way, which I think is great. I have to say, we use Canvas and I use a function where you can bring a drop-down menu up under a quiz to message people, hey, just a reminder that you haven't taken this, low stakes open resource quiz. You haven't taken this quiz yet, and it's due this Friday, just a reminder. And it's an automated thing. You click message every student who hasn't taken it. And it's a standard, hey, reminder, take this quiz. And I get individual responses. Oh, I'm so sorry. They think it's coming to them that you have sat there and done it individually, which is kind of, I don't know. I feel bad about it a little bit, but But it works. It works. They get, you know, some engagement.
I think sometimes too, we underutilize those tracking resources in our courses. I always think it's fun to look at the first couple weeks and the amount of access and the activities they look at towards the end of the class. That's sort of my way of telling what the students found most important. If by the end of the class, they're still opening the study guide or the practice quiz, I know that those were the more important things and I see less opening the chapters and the textbooks. So to me, that's a good thing. That means my students are figuring out what's going to make them most successful, but it also probably tells us what we need to spend our time continuing to update and revamp and make sure is accurate. So I think sometimes we underutilize those resources. It's all happening in the background.
I think another resource is quiz feedback. And I know that I'm not going to steal your thunder because I know you're doing a presentation on tomorrow, but I was just at Billy's presentation on cognitive domain, evaluating cognitive domain. And he talked about the importance of going in and giving feedback, not just for the right answer, but for the wrong ones too, so that, and giving a reference for it so that they have that. And students love to get that feedback. They feel like they're learning, or they have some, they understand why they've missed that.
And I think instructors sometimes can misconstrue when the students bring them the questions that don't make sense. Like, this one doesn't make any sense to me. And you're like, if you just do the quiz feedback, and then the student gets it in real time. To me, if they're bringing you those questions that don't make sense, that shows me that you need the feedback. That feedback is important to the student because they were motivated enough to like be pissed about it all night, yes, to come to me the next morning and be like, I don't agree with this question. I'm like, that's the importance of quiz feedback. But also, like, students want that. It's important enough to them that they held on to that until the next day of class.
Yeah, they do.
That's really great that we know that annotated responses are really helpful in multiple choice quizzes and practice quizzes. We know that practice quizzing is an active learning strategy. Yes. So that's one of those strategies that could have been in the email about improving.
Sure, yeah.
But thinking about feedback to students, that's what the session is on tomorrow. The session is about growth, giving feedback in a way that supports growth mindset. And so some of those strategies are things like when focusing less on performance, but encouraging learners to be only competing with themselves, not trying to compete mm-hmm. with the rest of the class, and really looking at their last performance and what has been the growth or improvement from their last performance. Did they improve by 2 points, or are they getting better at a particular domain within that? So for us, maybe it's they're improving their airway score, or if they're getting a printout that shows them their knowledge, application, problem solving domains, are they getting better at their application and problem solving questions? Mm-hmm. So they're getting better at the critical thinking items. It's having them use their, you know, self-regulatory skills and sort of setting some goals, and then thinking about what do they want to get better at, or looking at their performance data and saying, where do I need to improve, and helping them sort of reflect on that, and then giving them feedback specific to where they have set goals and where they're improving, and saying, I notice that you're using those strategies, or I notice that you got better in this particular area. And one more area is incorporation of feedback. So I gave you feedback on this, and I see that you were incorporating that feedback, and this has improved since the last time that we talked about this. Because how often do you sort of want to shake a kid because you're like, we have talked about this 47 times, or you're like, I know the skills instructors have told you this, I have told you this, preceptors have mentioned it, like, it's you, like, there is a pattern here that needs to be addressed, and they're just not hearing it. So these are the things that we want to, that can help somebody focus, you know, give feedback in a growth mindset, is focusing on the incorporation of feedback. You heard us, and I see that you're making an effort to address it. And that helps the learner really know what to focus on and how to prioritize our feedback. Because of course, there's, you know, 47 things we all could get better at, but which three do I need to focus on
right now? I'm glad you put it that way, because it sometimes you can feel like, okay, it's not magic fairy dust. It's not like, okay, apply these things and magic fairy dust, all your students are going to get better. I love that, you know, how you're using the feedback. That's very helpful. So this is, let's look at some of the two tables, or the two
figures.
Figures. Yeah. So this is the first figure. So this one is on exam three. So again, exam two, we are seeing no significant difference, but exam three, we start to see a positive effect with a larger, incidentally, you actually get a positive effect across the board between the control and growth mindset conditions. But you see a larger positive effect for first generation college students. And again, the gap is what I see immediately is you've closed a gap right here.
Yeah, you brought your first generation college students to the same level and really squared away the playing field by just giving them some positive encouragement and some of those study skills. I also think it's interesting as we talk about the students who've had parents in college before, this is beneficial to them because oftentimes, like I think like my parent, I had one parent that had gone to college, but they never instilled in me how they studied for exams when they made it to college. So I think like there's maybe an assumption that they certainly have some advantages in some areas, but in the study skills, they probably need to know how to study just as much as everybody else does. Yeah. So by giving them these growth mindsets, you're also giving them those tools that, you know, they probably didn't get in high school. I think if most people think back to high school, you just sort of memorized your way through what you needed to. So now we're truly giving you the strategies necessary to make it through the exam.
And if people want to know the definition of equity, I think you're seeing it when you see this gap closed. And that's what we're talking about is what we're reaching for in education and actually in health and healthcare too is equity. And so when you can close these gaps and make it so that students, and whether they're first generation or you know, or not, or continuing generation can succeed, then that's what we're talking about. So these are great graphs to illustrate, you know, equity. This is also now the course GPA. One of the things to illustrate too is you might see, remember, this is an online course. We don't know, and we do know traditionally underrepresented minorities perform poorly compared to non-underrepresented minorities in online courses. Traditionally, I don't know if that's changed over time, but this is an online course. We don't know about who came to the table as well. So that's, again, I think it makes it even more powerful, the changes, because if we're already starting with people who have that resilience and grit and I'm here, I'm going to do this regardless of COVID and everything else, I'm going to take this online course. And we still see this difference. We really have narrowed it down to this first generation status.
I think that goes back to something I said earlier too, which is this is the class that tells you whether or not you should do this or not, right? If you fail introduction to biology, you're probably not going on and getting a biology degree.
Yeah.
If we can raise the bar for that success, we have a huge impact later on in your college career, in your career choice. So I really think that goes back to that, the sort of the weed out classes. We are definitely weeding out people who could probably do it. They just need the strategy to do it.
Yeah. And GPA is the other one here. And I think GPA is super important. This one is, I think, very compelling because GPA matters in the STEM fields. It you know, I'm not supporting that necessarily, but it does. And it's even fractions of a point can matter if you're in a competitive field. So did you have something that you wanted to add?
Just to Michael's point about the weed out in this course, but we know that underrepresented students often take longer to finish it when they are able to persist. And so having to repeat this course or failing this course also can change the trajectory, because this course probably, a course like this is probably also a prerequisite to take other courses like chemistry or organic chemistry. Mm-hmm. There's sequences to these courses too. And so if they are telling themselves, oh, I did so bad, I better drop this course, I'll take it again, which actually I had that experience. I had never ever gotten a C in a course in my life. So as a freshman in college, I was getting a C in chemistry and was like, no way can I have a C on my transcript, drop it, and then took it again. And, you know, so, you know, you get off track a little bit and then things could take you longer. And so which also means more expense. And so we have to think about these additional barriers that get built in when the messages they're telling themselves are, I'm not good enough, I didn't do it, or I can't do it. And so I think that was really powerful what you said about accidentally weeding out or changing somebody's trajectory or their path. And so being able to keep them in, keep them engaged, and keep them on time and on path is very important.
Yeah. Another barrier might be too, I've heard of some, and I know nursing does it, where you have a timeline, right, to complete your science courses. And if you've taken them over 7 years, they're no longer good. But I have heard of students who have taken a nursing, a science course, maybe got a C in it. They'd really like to up their GPA. So they want to retake that class maybe 5 years later, within that timeline, within the 7 years, and they retake it. But the application says, no, we only take your first grade. Mm-hmm. I said, aren't you penalizing resistance? persistence.
Again, those first semesters of college, you're learning all the things that you need in college besides the biology curriculum, right? Yeah. You're learning all of those study skills. It's so important to success that, like, God forbid we demonstrate learning over time.
That time and versus competency is going to be another one.
I would add to what you're learning. You're learning whether or not the institution, the people, think you belong.
Yeah.
Right. And so if you take this class and you get a message or a class like this that is determinative, you may be getting a message that we, the collective we, faculty, administration, the institution, doesn't think you belong here because you're struggling in an entry-level class. There's not the support. You're pushed back in a small school. You know, being pushed back may mean a year's delay.
Yeah.
And again, we point out the longer delay, the less likely students are to persist and complete. So this may feel low stakes to some of us who are, you know, through all of this, or through some of it anyway. But this could be very high stakes and not just like academic path determinative, but job determinative. And does somebody persist in an institution that they feel like they're getting a message that says, you're not fit for our institution?
Yeah. Right?
We're not just weeding you out of this course potentially, we're weeding you out of the institution and higher education and a whole bunch of other things.
An institution that most likely has an equity message up front on their website in the mission. FYI.
Everyone's welcome.
Everyone's welcome to pay us, but once you get here, it changes.
Yeah. The other thing that they showed, which isn't in a table, but it's in the paper, is that the growth mindset intervention increased web page activity. And there were 41 more clicks on course materials web pages, which was a 12% increase in engagement, not on the grade book, but in the course materials across the board for the growth mindset group versus the control group. And that was regardless of whether there was first generation or continuing generation. So, again, leveling and closing those gaps, this seems like a really effective strategy.
An easy effective strategy.
Yes.
Right. For one, the supplement has the emails that you can edit to send out. So we're not raising that bar so high that it's impossible to do. But this is a fairly easy thing to implement. I think Sahej said it best. You do this tomorrow if you wanted to.
Yeah.
You know, this isn't a big thing to do.
Literally could automate. You could write them all tomorrow, automate them with to send them out, and you could never think about it again.
I was actually thinking that, and I was wondering, so, you know, students come in at 8:00, they take their test. Because when Megan, you mentioned timing, I was thinking, okay, so I'm probably not going to, I could literally delay send the emails to that evening, right? Give them a little bit of time to process, let them talk to their friends, sort of vent through I've just taken an exam, I failed, I don't fail tests, you know, or like, oh, I don't know if this is right for me. And then later that evening, after they've sort of made it through the grieving process, if you will, then they get that email that's like, actually, you can do this.
Yeah.
How we think you can do this, or how people have done it in the past. I was thinking that same thing. I was like, you could easily just write these emails, delay send them, or the next morning, like on their drive to class, they're like, oh, I really should do this.
In a sense, it probably helped that this was online too, because people wouldn't be in class. Did you get that email?
Yeah.
I got a different one.
I think there's something to that. Yeah, like sending it at home, like when they're at home later in the day, sort of seems like. I will say we have 5 minutes left.
Yeah.
So I thought maybe ask our special guests any final closing thoughts.
Anything from the chat too, Kim?
I just sent that. Nobody has any questions so far in the chat.
Okay. We had a couple folks in person. Thanks so much for coming too. And do you guys have any input? We also have Bill Toon, but I'm kind of ignoring you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just, to me, if there's one big takeaway from this, it is make sure we're examining how we're communicating with students and be thoughtful about it, right? And I think it's important, we're talking about a growth mindset, it's important for us as educators to have a growth mindset about how we educate as well, yeah. Right? The way we've done something for X number of years may actually, it turns out, not be the best way for us to be doing those things. We're all used to that, changes in CPR, whatever. There needs to be, at times, changes in how we communicate with our students. So look at how you're communicating with students, when, how, what are you saying? And it's, again, very low bar, easy entry for us to start communicating with more of a growth mindset mentality to our students and have a positive impact on the likelihood of their success.
Great.
And I guess I would say that one of the reasons that we're so focused on growth mindset, or you're hearing so much about it or reading so much about it, is because we know that learners and employees who have a growth mindset are more likely to persist in either their educational journey or in their occupation longer. They're more likely to stick around. They're more likely to describe happiness or delight in their experience. They're more joyful and they experience less stress and burnout. And so isn't that what we're trying to achieve, whether we're talking about the classroom or our workplaces? And so we want that for all of the folks that we interact with, whether they're our learners, our trainees, or our employees. And so that's why we're talking about growth mindset. We're thinking about it. And the other is the way that I describe it, I can sort of picture the slide when I'm teaching people about it, is it's a gradient, right? That we tend to be more growth mindset in different areas of our life. Like, you can think about something in your life where you're very good. You're good about being growth mindset, probably a sport or a hobby or something you've been working on your whole life, where you remind yourself and you're good about persistence and you seek feedback and you like coaching and no problem. You're good about all of that, those messages about strategy and keep working on it. I don't mind. And then there's other areas of your life where you're a little more performance oriented. You're a little more fixed and those tend to be things, frankly, around our job or things where we're a little worried that it's a grade or it's for pay or not get a promotion or somebody's judging us, and we have to then be more active in the process of being growth mindset. We have to remind ourselves to relax and to focus on the strategies, and that's okay that we are sort of on that journey or that gradient all the time. It's helpful though, and we know this because we're thinking about it and we're reading about it and we're studying it, but not everybody understands this difference between growth and fixed. And so teaching people that it is fixable, it's changeable, it's malleable, that we didn't pop out of the womb molded clay, right? Yeah. It's all still malleable. We didn't come out a figurine and that's made out of, whatever jade or cement or whatever substance, steel.
We aren't Pittsburgh, we'll go with steel.
Steel, we'll go with steel. That it's all changeable, that those are really important messages for whomever you're interested
in. Yeah, gosh.
Love it.
What
Love
a great it. Time. So I had a great time. Great Thanks takeaways. So much, everybody. This was really great. And anything?
So many great takeaways. A big thank you to the authors for publishing this, doing this work, and then sharing all of the resources with us.
Yes. And thank you to all the educators out there. We're all together on this. And even though this is a study that comes from one college, we could form a network and try it out and present it at NEMC and talk to each other and about how this is working. So thanks for joining us. You can join us next time on Friday, September 27th. We're going to be talking about artificial intelligence to create diverse and inclusive medical case vignettes for education. Another good article. But you can join Dr. Renly Crow and Dr. Tony Fernandez on Monday, September 9th for the Clinical Journal Club. And to join us live each month, you can go to prehospitalcare.org and register. And remember to join us on our YouTube channel. You can subscribe and you can get all of our past episodes. All right. Thanks, everybody. We're going back to the conference. Have a good weekend. I guess it's weekend. Yeah. Have a good weekend. Happy weekend.
Thanks, Megan and Michael. Nice job.
There's an outro that's going to play real fast.
Maybe. Yeah, there it goes. We hope you have enjoyed and learned from this PCRF Journal Club. Please share it with other interested EMS professionals. An archive of past journal clubs can be found at www.pcrfpodcasts.org. You can also find us on Facebook at PCRF at UCLA and on our website at www.prehospitalcare.org. A special thank you to our sponsor, Limmer Education, providing education tools for success at every stage of your EMS journey.